Welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, the Maine Audio Information and Reading Service, a program of the IRIS Network, serving Maine's blind and visually impaired. My name is Cynthia Bowman, and I'm reading The Log of the Skipper's Wife, the diary of Dorothea Moulton Bellano, edited by her son, James W. Bellano. The Log of the Skipper's Wife was published by Down East Books in 1979. It is the diary of Mrs. Bellano, covering the time from June 1910 through January 1913 while she lived at sea, taking off from Maine again and again for foreign parts. Her son, James W. Bellano, has edited the text. He introduces our subject in the preface. The Log of the Skipper's Wife, Episode 1, Preface. The first thing that comes to mind for a preface to my mother's diary is that she always got a big kick out of the fact that her seagoing husband had no time for learning how to spell the word preface. Captain Fred got the letters right by taking the first of each of the following words, Peter Rabbit eats fish and catches eels. As long as he could use words relating to the sea, he could remember how to spell. Thus, with her help, Schenectady was composed of the abbreviation for the word schooner, S-C-H, followed by his familiar E-N-E for east-northeast. That got him as far as Schenectady, and from there on she told him he was on his own, and that if he couldn't remember the K-D-D, he should call her. He persevered and came up with the congenial thought that cod tongues are dandy. For him, this was extremely satisfying inefficiency, but it was never to be forgotten by me. I still use it. And cod tongues are dandy. When my mother told of her Sioux Indian neighbors in Yellow Medicine County, Minnesota, where she was born on November 25, 1882, Captain Fred felt uneasy because there was no conceivable C words for use in memorizing the spelling of the word Sioux. I believe he went to his grave with that one unsolved. It helped a bit when she told him it was a French way to spell Sioux, S-U, but she got way past him when she opined that Sioux, S-U, in turn, was the Altaic word for water. Now, water rang a bell with him, and for years to come he would tell friends that his wife had known some water Indians who, of course, must have been all right, being sailors. So good at words was Dorothea Honora Moulton Bellano that she learned enough Sioux to converse with a band of Dakota Sioux who visited her father's quarter-section farm to bid her father farewell as they embarked on their long trek to sanctuary in Canada. The Sioux presented my mother and her two sisters and brother with homemade dolls. She was 4 years old and sang goodbye to the Washte, good, Indian neighbors, she said, made her feel terribly sikidoh, bad. My mother told me that her diary started then, but that part of it has never been found. To make up for the loss, she later had her mother and her grandmother write down their impressions of those days and add some history of the family. Those old notebooks are filled with the westward trend of Moultons, Putnams, Kennedys, Brewsters, and Dorrances from Plymouth and Salem to Maine, Vermont, New York State, Illinois, Minnesota, and beyond. Those notebooks tell how Dorothea's grandmother, Martin, held a looking glass to the mouth of her daughter, Laura Martin Dorrance, to determine whether there was any breath left in the baby during a bout with pneumonia in the blizzard of 1850. The nearest doctor was 200 miles across the prairie. Of more concern to the women was the absence of a minister. All through the faded pages of the copybooks are hopes that their little congregation might entice a man of God to join them. They needed someone who could dwell on the word Sundays and on work the rest of the week. They could not pay him for ministering, but they might feed him and provide shelter. Dorothea learned from the itinerant ministers and from her mother. She devoured the Blackstone of her Justice of the Peace father. At 9, she was sent to the local school at the county seat and went home to help with spring planting, summer cultivating, and the harvest. After high school, she had to teach for 2 years to earn enough money for train tickets to Minneapolis and the University of Minnesota, where, fortunately, she had a fairly well-to-do relative, Aunt Sue Kingman, who helped out with room, board, friends of cultural interest, and, most important, an introduction to opportunity for indulging Dorothea's inborn taste for travel. Aunt Sue was a Brewster. She thought more of her electric car than of being a Mayflower descendant. And travel Dora did. Her summer vacation trips to the Pacific and Canada were exuberantly noted in her diary of 1908 to 1909, as was her decision to get away from mere U.S. and Canadian travel by signing up to teach in Puerto Rico. The diary, as I know it, was started in 1908 in cheap notebooks. She told me several times that she would one day edit it for publication. The author, Peter B. Kine, one of whose books was Cappy Ricks, The Story of Matt Peasley of Thomaston, Maine, once got her to help him in seagoing terminology. Upon learning that she had kept a diary, he offered to help her ready it for publishing. At the time, they were working on his book in San Francisco during a short visit there by Dorothea and her husband when he was master of the steamer Peter Crowell. But the World War interfered, and Dorothea immersed herself in war activities, building the Port Clyde Public Library, promoting chapters of the Daughters of the American Revolution, journeying to distant ports to meet her husband, then a commander in charge of transports to France, running the local Port Clyde estate of her husband, and, between 6 and 7 each evening, inundating my brother and me with books written in 3 languages. After World War I, Dorothea went to sea with Captain Fred in steam, visiting much of Europe, North Africa, South America, and the West Indies, none of which was covered by diary, but most of which was related to me by letter and conversation. From 1923 to 1927, she lived at Gardena, California, in order to be near the ports of Wilmington and San Pedro, to which her husband's ship came north from the Panama Canal, en route from Liverpool, Glasgow, Hamburg, and Antwerp. She made several of those trips with him, and went along the Pacific coast as well with him. Then she went ashore, because Captain Fred took a shore job in New York as a marine insurance executive. Although the family got to Maine several times a year and continued to feel that New York was no more than a port of call, Dorothea saw and heard every opera at the Metropolitan several times each, became regent of the state DAR, more or less ran the National Motion Picture Board of Review in order to see more movies than she thought she ought to pay to see, and each September deloused my clothes when I would come home from a summer trip at sea, starting at age 13, wages $27 a month. So Dorothea had little time for editing what she called my scribbling, and less interest in the past than in her hectic present, and her plans for future trips to just anywhere. She took my brother and me to do the grand tour of Europe one summer, when I would have preferred to accept the glorious job of bosun, which was offered me at the age of 16 by a Maine skipper. My brother and I spent the 2 months visiting cathedrals, with one eye on the lookout for Coca-Cola signs. She made us drink our first beer in Lucerne, because we had entered the beer hall where Wagner composed parts of The Ring, drinking beer. She was indomitable, and her spirit comes through a bit in the log of the Shipper's Wife. Maine skippers often took their wives to sea, as did other seafarers. Europeans still do it. In my parents' day, many master mariners owned part of their ships, and most of them felt as though they owned the whole ship. There was no question of insurance or Coast Guard regulations. Going to sea with your wife was the accepted thing. As late as 1927, my mother went to sea with her husband, and she took along a sister who became engaged to the chief engineer. Whole families, such as the Colcord family of Searsport, lived aboard ship. Lincoln and Johanna Colcord looked upon their father's square rigger as their home, their school, and their asylum from provincial boredom. For anyone thinking it unusual that a family prefer a home at sea to one ashore, I recommend a trip to Hong Kong, where many families still live afloat. Short of that, join Dorothea for a voyage down to the sea in a tall ship with a star to steer her by. James Wilfred Bellano, Bucksport, Maine. And now for the text. The Log of the Skipper's Wife. June 21st, 1910. Utuado, Puerto Rico. Hell of a day. Exams for my eighth graders, but no mail from the States. The SS Carolina spitefully had a collision in New York Harbor, and her mailbags are rumored to be sent on the SS Caracas for arrival next week. Ohala, editors note, Ohala is a word that comes from the Muslim occupation of Spain and is a plea to Allah. As Betty and I were booked on the Carolina for our return trip to New York after 2 years' exile, we'll be desperate to find another way of getting home. Betty's beau, a Captain Bellano from Maine, has often schemed to take her north with me as chaperone. Chaperone? Bah! Think of something more pleasant than being a chaperone, a killjoy, an envious witness to rounds of tickle and slap. Oh, yes! Had the time of my life Saturday night. Good Latin music. I do love flutes in a dance orchestra. How these Latinos can fandango. They loved my yellow dress. Drank champagne, and mercy, it's expensive stuff. Don Jorge's inherited thousands will soon evaporate at the rate we downed the bubbly. June 23rd, 1910. I wonder if we shall sail north on Captain Bellano's schooner. Also hope. No, I'll bet it's ridden with fleas and cockroaches. He once kidded Betty, telling her cockroaches on board were good signs. Hungry ships don't attract roaches, he said. But if his foremaster is half as clean and nice as the Governor Powers, which Betty and I visited to see Captain and Mrs. Kent of Cutler, Maine, it'll be heavenly. The Powers is a Maine vessel, too. June 25th. First came a letter from Betty Holbrook with a photo of her captain. A wonderful Roman nose and eyes to match, roaming. I wonder. Then a telegram from Betty saying, we're invited to sail north with him. I felt like refusing out of plain contrariness to be a chaperone of that man. After having chaperoned my eighth grade all year, but being contrary, I got contrary against my contrariness and sent word I'd go. What convulsions of reasoning can be prompted by the picture of a good-looking young sea captain? Poor Betty. God bless her and help her. I'll take a load of magazines and books along to keep me and my eyes busy. I don't want to take them at all. June 29th, 1910. On board the schooner R.W. Hopkins at Aguirre Sugar Central, Puerto Rico. So much has happened this past 4 days I can hardly write about it adequately. First Betty's telegram, then going to Ponce. Ferns on the mountain rocks, immense stately clouds hanging on the mountain peaks we passed by. Last view of the mists in the hills as we descended to the southern coastal plain. the clouds and mists hanging on to lovely Puerto Rico until the trade winds pushed them west, and that exquisite 19th kilometer stop for sliced pineapple and chunks of papaya in the little hacienda guest house overlooking the blue Caribbean from up high on the mountain divide. No refund check from the steamship company, but that didn't ruin the trip, not much. Captain Bolano is not only handsome with a smile that melts, but also seems perfectly splendid as well. Betty is a lucky girl and a perfect darling. Friday morning, July 1st, 1910, Aguirre. Dinner Wednesday night on board the Governor Powers with Betty, Captain Bolano, and the Kents. Aren't they the loveliest people? Have been so busy I've slighted you, my diary, so now to calmly retrace the progress. At Ponce, Betty and I engaged two coaches to come along the coast to Aguirre. One contained the trunks and the other, Betty and yours truly. Some auto drivers offered to take us, but we scornfully turned them away and had eyes only for the horses and the coche with white-fringed tops. Without noise and bumping, we could chat like civilized people. Betty is afraid she'll be seasick. I hope she won't be. Don't feel like being a nurse as well as a chaperone. Arrived at Aguirre, and Betty bravely sailed into the office of the sugar company to ask for Captain Bolano. I don't believe those poor lads have yet recovered from their surprise. They passed us through the gates and down to the wharf. We walked and talked and consulted, and finally sat ourselves dignifiedly down and quietly waited in our coach. I hailed some boys, and they assured me with all the duplicity of which they are masters that they would walk the narrow brow to the schooner and get the captain. Young ladies aren't supposed to range the Puerto Rican waterfront soliciting seamen. They went with knowing smiles, but soon our captain appeared. Such a lovely schooner, 4 masts. She must be a beauty when the sails are up. A charmingly arranged little captain. Little cabin. We have the captain's room. To his company and, what was I going to say? Sunday morning, July 3rd, 1910. Thursday evening came Marco, the general factotum from the Sugar Central, he of the yes, 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 which he apparently uses all the time, whether he means it or not. With him were 2 young heathens from the mill, chemists they were, out to see what prizes the captain had got. In Spanish, the word is procurado, procured. They came and saw, but did not conquer. One was a quiet little lad from Hawaii, with enormous, unquiet eyes. And Friday, such a day! We went on shore in the morning to call on the Murhoffs, the doctor whose little Puerto Rican wife is a cousin of the Hurtado Caballeros. Saw the McLeans and Miss Wood in a beautiful large home on top of the hill where flamboyant trees were gloriously red. The house has about 1,000,000 rooms, with a schoolroom on the 3rd floor, overlooking miles upon miles of shimmering gray-blue sea, hedged by broken lines of foam and surf and islands that invite. As luck would have it, Dame Fortune smiled on us. Or was it Captain Bolano who smiled? And we went for a drive along the beautiful coast to Guyama in the McLean's auto. Returned to Morhoff's for a lunch of succulent lecon asado, roast young piglets on spits with sauces. Paris could envy. There we met Mrs. Chisholm. Curiosity killed a cat, but never a Chisholm. Saturday came a letter from the steamship company agreeing to refund our passage money on the Carolina, but no check, of course. Betty and I went with the captain to the customs office at Arroyo to clear for Boston. The man with the 3 yeses accompanied us, but Captain Bolano did the work. More smiles from Dame Fortune? Returning, that villainous cochera wanted to bring a goat along in a box, but Betty and I could not agree to suffer his blatting all the way back to the ship, so finally the creature was removed, with much blatting from the goat and the cochero. We returned in peace and smelled the sea instead of the animal. Just as bad was being intercepted by Mrs. Chisholm as we neared the wharf. She wanted us for lunch, she said, but we knew it was to feed the rumor mill, so we pleaded headaches. When we arrived on board, the awning was down as the crew prepared the ship for an early sailing in the morning. I got sea fever and couldn't think of sleeping. Such a night! Even the little stars were out, and there was a small new moon on the horizon. Wrote letters for the States Mail, telling my poor family of the venture their wayward daughter is undertaking. All sails set, and we look like a great white winged bird as we roll stately over a sapphire sea, along a dim outline of hazy mountains. It was a memorable experience to wake from a short nap at 4 a.m. to the sound of creaking rigging. Barely did we rush into a few clothes and scurry on deck when the mizzen sail majestically lifted and straightened. The gray darkness slowly lightened, and we watched the fore and mainsails rise against the little low moon. Halyards loosened and slackened, finally taking their proper lengths. Great booms swung into position with the breeze. With the coming of dawn and a great ball of sun, Captain Bolano whistled for the pilot to hurry aboard. He spoke only the King's Spanish, and I was happy to translate a bit, although I found that seaman's talk is neither English nor Spanish, but a code of grunts, pointing, and gesticulation. To avoid the mud shoals in the narrow channel and lift the ship on her way, the spanker had to be partly hoisted for a few minutes. That extra power did the work, and soon we were free, the prow, proa, pointing west. With a lazy majesty and billowing grace, the good ship, R.W. Hopkins, put to sea as though some stately creature had communed with the moon and stars and then bowed to their master, the sun, who would now lead the way. She is loaded with molasses, a cargo valued at $14,000. Shall I write my WCTU mother that New England rum will be the end product? No, I'll concentrate on the use of molasses for cookies. Out through the buoys, black on the starboard bow and red on the port, the pilot said adios. He had made $39, paid by the central, and an easy gain because the captain piloted the pilot. A man is always at the wheel. The mate eats at our table. The second mate and the engineer eat at the second table. I ate a hearty breakfast, but poor Betty did not. I don't know how much more I can eat without letting out a few seams. And I'm ashamed to be seen enjoying food so much in front of Betty. She told the captain that her stomach was weak, and he didn't help matters at all by telling her she must have a strong stomach by the way she was throwing food over the side farther than anyone he had ever seen. The brute. 8 bells is either 4, 8, or 12 o'clock. Each half hour is marked by lovely bells. After the boys and the pilot became ancient history, the crew hoisted the jibs, outer, flying, main, and forestay sail, and finished raising the largest sail on board, the spanker. Then the topsails were loosened and set, all four. We plowed past Caja de Muertos at 8, when the watch was changed. Betty still seasick, and the captain scrubbing the dirt of land off his white paint. I'd take a bath, but I'm sure this sea would toss me out of the tub. The wind is dead aft and breezing up. I'll tell my farmer father that it comes from the rear. I hope that if I do get sick, it won't be until Betty is better. The captain asked me to help him stand the evening watch on deck. He seems every inch a man, and a handsome one at that. I wonder how it will all come out. Dios sabe. July 5th, 1910. Betty is better today. July 6th, 1910. Dorothea Moulton, you are the biggest fool that ever lived. I am heartily ashamed of you. Am too disgusted with you to write any more. You should have told him in a nice way that you were ticklish or something, instead of enjoying it. Poor dear Betty. Please hurry up and get well. July 7th, 1910. A flying fish flew on board this morning and died soon after striking the deck. Royal purple and soft opalescent sunset last night, as seen from my deck chair atop the house, or is it called the after cabin? Betty is a little better. My salt water bath with salt water soap is awaiting. I'll soak and think. Does that lovely copper bathtub give off thoughts? Today is our fifth day out, and the good breeze holds. The RWH slides along easily over the swells. Such sapphire water up forward under the bow. I sat there for hours yesterday, still thinking, among the anchors, jibs, bowsprit, and jib-boom. Iron chains by the dozens, and the capstan painted a hideous pink so it can be seen at night. The life of a common sailor is worse than that of a slave. This captain sells them clothes and soap and tobacco at 100% or more profit, to be paid for from their paltry $25 a month wage. Perfectly scandalous. Remember that, my girl, when next he casts those roaming eyes on you and smiles. Ship's philosophy? Keep them in debt so they can't afford to leave, especially a good cook. Sailors are sometimes put in chains in the lazarette. Went below to see it yesterday and rummaged through my trunk to find my tennis shoes. Now I can move about with greater assurance against the rolls and pitches. But instead of more exploring, must write some letters. Still owe part of my college tuition loan. Must also write parents who'd never believe all of this way out on the Minnesota farm. That's all we have time for in this edition of the Maine Reader. We're reading The Log of the Skipper's Wife, the diary of Dorothea Moulton Bellano, edited by her son, James W. Bellano. I'm Cynthia Bowman. Thank you for listening.